Welcome to The Mountain Life. I'm Mary Beth Maziarz. Today we welcome Dr. Paul Sunseri, who's written a new book called Gentle Parenting Reimagined: How to Make It Work with Oppositional and Defiant Kids. If you've ever found yourself at wit's end with a child's behavior, you know the complexity of the challenges and questions that come up about what really works and feels good for both you and the child. But perhaps parents just need a new set of tools to deal with their defiant children, and Dr. Sunseri just may have some new strategies. Dr. Paul Sunseri, welcome to The Mountain Life.
Thank you so much. It's a pleasure to be here.
Great. Well, the term gentle parenting, I know it's been around, but I don't know that much about it. I think about either authoritative parenting or permissive parenting. Could you give us a little bit of a definition about what is gentle parenting?
Of course, absolutely. So the idea has been around for about 10 years. And the idea behind gentle parenting is it really tries to stress parents and their children having the closest relationship that they possibly can. So there's an emphasis on being attuned to your kids, being attentive. And when they struggle in some way, say, I don't know, they become emotionally reactive or they're not listening to you, what gentle parenting advocates is trying to lean into your kids under those circumstances and really trying to adopt an empathetic response.
So, is there a specific type of child that responds best to gentle parenting, or is it really an approach we could start with all children?
Well, I like the idea of being gentle. Like, I think, for example, if all parents defaulted to being gentle most of the time, I don't think you can go wrong with that. I think most people like the idea, actually. And I think that would work just fine with most kids. The problem, however, comes in when you have a particularly difficult to parent child. And some kids are just like that. I think they come into the world being harder than others. And I don't think the gentle parenting style, at least as people typically understand it, would work. 7 or 8 year old and they're throwing a temper tantrum. They're mad about something. Usually kids get mad when somebody tells them no, or there's something that they want that they can't have. But if they're yelling and, you know, very upset about all of that, a gentle parent would really try to lean in and understand. They would say, tell me what's going on with you. I think that's fine. But with some kids, that is actually the wrong approach. And it's also the approach that's not actually supported by the empirical evidence, right? I think when you have a kid who's very emotionally reactive or maybe leans more towards the oppositional or non-compliant side, that gentle parenting doesn't work so well under those circumstances. You know, if a kid is upset and telling you no about everything and you're trying to understand every little need that's going on, I think what becomes missing from that is just basic limit setting, right? You know, it's not okay for you to behave this way. You do need to do what I ask you to do. When you've got a naturally more difficult child, what it requires is a skill set, an additional skill set that typically is not included in gentle parenting when you think of it in its most basic form. That was a long answer. I
No,
hope.
that was terrific. And what maybe how would we start? What would be the precepts of starting working through gentle parenting with a child who is a little bit more oppositional or noncompliant?
So I've worked with children and families for 40 years as a psychologist. And the kids that I work with, not all of them, obviously, but many of them are very challenging in ways that, you know, the typical parent doesn't necessarily ever encounter. So these are kids who are massively oppositional. They rarely follow directions. And so parents struggle with trying to figure out how do you get a kid to do their homework? How do you get them to be respectful or not fight with their siblings? These are also kids who are highly emotionally reactive, right? It's not just a five-year-old temper tantrum, but it's a 16-year-old who gets so angry that they curse at their parents or kick holes in the walls or demolish their bedrooms. That's the sort of family that I work with. And what I've learned about parents is they're so well-intentioned, but they're desperate to learn how to change all of that. And I don't think that skill set is one that your average or typical parent has, right? There's no book that I've ever read that tells you how to do that, which is why I wrote my book. And so really what they want from me is, well, what do I do? How do I get my kid to do their homework? How do you get them to not curse at me or to yell or just to do simple everyday things without it turning into a massive fight? So there are many, many strategies for doing that. And because I've been doing it for so long, I've had so many opportunities to come up with interventions and then test out whether they work. I think I've worked with over 1,000 kids by now easily. And so what I did over time is the strategies that were effective, I kept them. And that's what I teach people. And the strategies that didn't work, I got rid of those. So over time, I think I've kind of cracked the code on this. I know what works with hard kids, and I can get very hard kids most of the time to do exactly what most parents would want them to do.
So here's an example. All right.
Sure.
I had a very, my sons, who are absolutely delightful humans now, but
Right.
one of them, when he was little, was just a really sensitive kid. And he had a hard time with transitions. He just would have a meltdown frequently. And it kind of took over our lives, our whole family's lives, not just my husband's and mine, but our other child as well. So if we're at a store and he can't get something that he wants and he's losing it, how would I respond in the techniques of gentle parenting that you're finding are effective?
It's an excellent question. And my answer is going to apply not just to 5-year-olds in a grocery store, but it applies equally well to a 15 or 16-year-old who does the same thing. You know, a tantrum is a tantrum. We use the word tantrum for young kids. With teenagers, we've kind of swapped that word out with being dysregulated. That's the one that's become most common. But let me answer. My wife teases me that I'm long-winded. So if I go on too long, feel free to interrupt me. But here's the thing. So often when kids have a meltdown, and this is what gentle parenting tells you to do too, which is not correct, but often what parents will do is they will try to reason with the kid. They will talk to the kid. They'll say things like, you know, come on, honey. You know, we really need to get through our shopping at the store, and I'm sorry, but I can't buy you this. There's just far too much communication. And gentle parenting takes that to an extreme where it's nothing but communication, like, you know, trying to understand what the child is feeling and empathize way too much. What works a lot better with kids who have meltdowns is you actually give them less attention rather than more. And that doesn't mean you ignore them. It doesn't mean you stop speaking to them, although in more extreme cases you do. But tantrums, they have a way of burning themselves out fairly naturally. And you can get into a loop with kids where if you engage too much in a temper tantrum, if you have too much communication and give them too much attention, that all by itself often keeps the tantrum alive and going. So what I teach parents to do, both with younger kids and with teenagers, is the minute they start to light up in some sort of an extreme way, the thing to do there is to say, I'm sorry, but I can't have a conversation with you when you're yelling at me, or I can't have a conversation with you when you're this angry. And then you stop speaking and you maybe turn your back on the child. You create a little physical distance in between them. Kids don't like that very much, so they'll continue to tantrum, but tantrums have a lifespan. The child eventually stops and settles down. And then as soon as they become calmer and more relaxed, that's when the parent fully engages again. It's, oh my gosh, I'm so happy that you've calmed down. Tell me what's going on. What's happening for you here? So the natural human tendency, again, what most parents do is they lean into temper tantrums to a degree that actually reinforces the thing you're trying to change. It's, again, all parents do this. Every parent I've ever met leans into a temper tantrum, but it works a lot better to lean out of a temper tantrum. You're still there and available and paying attention to what the child is doing. You're just not actually directly engaged. And when you apply that strategy over and over and over again, what it does for the child is it teaches them that it's sort of their job to calm themselves down, right? It's not necessarily the job of somebody in their environment to do that for them. So they acquire those emotion regulation skills very naturally. So as adults, this is what we all do. If we're upset about something, we just take some space, we walk away from the situation, but we do eventually calm down. Everybody's nervous system does. But that's the problem with tantrum, is often it's given far too much attention. So the example of a kid in the grocery store, I would probably just turn to them and say, I'm really sorry, but I can't buy you that cereal, and you know how that works. And then I go about my shopping. And if they continued to fuss and bother, at some point I'd say, I think it's time for us to go. You take them outside, you get them in the car, they'll probably be fussing the entire walk back to the car and probably in the car, but I'm sorry, I can't talk to you when you're having a tantrum. I can't and I won't.
So the idea of, you basically don't want to foster more of that energy by
exactly.
engaging more deeply and expanding upon that.
That's 100% correct. And again, works the same way with teenagers. It's just when they're mad and super angry and becoming disrespectful, it's peace out. I'm not going to engage under these circumstances. Calm down and then you have my attention and I'd be happy to help. I may not always say yes to what it is that you want. Lots of times I won't, but the yelling and the screaming is just not okay.
Okay. The one follow-up I do have to that though is when a child is young, you know, in all the baby books and the toddler books, they talk about, you know, creating emotional security. And how do I frame that for kids so they don't feel like abandoned or loved conditionally only?
I was talking to a fellow therapist once, and he said, well, isn't when you sort of disengagement is the word that I use in the book, when you disengage from a child, isn't that abandoning them? And my way of looking at it is, you know, if you dropped your child off on a street corner and drove away, that's abandonment, right? But to have a tantruming kid 10 feet away from you and you're basically just doing something else, that's not abandonment, right? It's far from it. And the minute the child starts to settle down, you're fully re-engaged again, and you're loving and you're kind and all the great parenting things that you bring to the equation. That's not at all abandonment. Now, with a 3-year-old who is doing this, it's a little different than a 10-year-old or a 12-year-old, but a 3-year-old, I'd lean in a little bit. I could tell you're super frustrated right now, but I'm going to give you a little bit of space to calm down. I'm right here when you need me. That doesn't feel
Okay.
like abandonment to me. That actually feels very loving.
Okay, and I guess it sets the pattern in place for them to learn. So hopefully by the time
Exactly.
they are 10, that they're not breaking down in those same ways.
Or
Well,
16 or 17, which is much worse.
so much worse. Well, here's a question. We seem to go back and forth a little bit in parenting trends in this pendulum. Back in the 50s, everyone seemed to be authoritarian. This is the way it is because I said so. Then it swung to a more gentle style. Some people even called it permissive parenting, which a lot of folks think also backfired. So, can you comment on the mistakes that some people make with a more permissive, gentle approach?
Well, there's a lot of research that's been done on permissive parenting. It's sort of the flip side of authoritarian parenting. Permissive parenting is kind of just super lax. Kids do what they want, they make their own decisions. You generally don't get very much involved if a child misbehaves or acts out in some way. It's kind of a kid-driven form of parenting. And what the research says about that is it just doesn't work. It ends up kids misbehave a lot more under permissive parenting. And often those kids grow up with a very strong sense of entitlement because it kind of got in their way the entire time they've been growing up. So permissive parenting is no good. And authoritarian parenting, which is what my parents did, do it because I said so, that's also not effective. You don't have close relationships with your kids. Kids tend to grow up being somewhat resentful of those parents because they can be very heavy-handed. The one that's right in the middle is authoritative. And that's sort of a balance between setting limits, but also being loving and attentive. That's what I'm kind of advocating for with my book on gentle parenting, which is, again, default to being gentle, to being kind and loving. But when your child misbehaves in some way, including particularly big ways, you can still be gentle as you intervene on those behaviors. But it also requires a degree of firmness and limit setting that I don't think the gentle parenting folks are particularly good at.
Sure, that makes a lot of sense. So let's skip to teenage years a little bit. What about if you've got a teenage boy specifically? It's tough to get them to talk about their feelings and to get them to kind of open up about what might really be going on. And the more you ask, it's like the more they clam up.
Well, sure.
How do we approach that, like creating that communicative base a little bit more effectively?
Couple quick tips that I think work really well with teenagers, boys and girls, actually. The first one is, I think you can actually have the best conversation with kids, not face to face the way we are right now. It's when you sit side by side. So if you're in a car with a kid, one, they're a captive audience for whatever the length of the drive is. And when you talk to a kid side by side, particularly boys, they're far more willing to be communicative. You have to catch them in the right space to begin with, obviously. That's why men stereotypically go out in garages with their neighbor to work on their cars, because you're not looking at each other, you're fixing the car. But we have great conversations with each other under those circumstances. It's a lot less emotionally threatening for men. The other thing is, what works great, not just with kids, but with adults who have a hard time talking about their feelings, is don't ask them to talk about their feelings. Is what works a lot better is to say, tell me your thoughts on this. And men are
Oh.
fine with this. Well, I think this is wrong, and it makes me really mad when that happens, and I can hear blah blah blah. So now they're talking just fine. And you get all of that data that's inside their head that maybe they weren't communicating to you. So,
Ah, I see.
yeah,
Yeah.
teenagers in general, they're not big on communication. They're not. They're more closed, they're more guarded, they really value their privacy. So, you know, it's not always easy to get the information out, but there are things that you can do that make them more open, more communicative.
Yeah, I remember years ago, my parents actually read this book, I think, called How to Talk So Kids Would Listen and Listen So Kids Would Talk. And
Oh,
it
yeah.
was a really good book. And one of the things they mentioned in that is that side-by-side element of it's less confrontational. People don't feel like they're in the hot seat. And our favorite way, our family, is to do that on the lifts. Here, because you're skiing, you've got about
Oh,
7 minutes to
yeah.
have a nice chat, and then you actually get a little breathing room to think about what you spoke about, and it's kind of nice.
It's a great idea. And plus, when you're on a lift and you're skiing, everybody's in a good mood, right? You're there to have fun and it's enjoyable. The kid would be in a great frame of mind under that circumstance, right? That's different than trying to get a kid to open up where they just got grounded. We're not going to talk to you about anything. No, that's brilliant, I think.
Thank you. And also, I love your thought thing about tell me your thoughts on this, because our kids today are pretty darn smart. They're much more sophisticated than kids were 20 years ago. And a lot of times, asking even, I'd like your advice about something,
Also
they
good.
step into this wonderful kind of knowledge base, and suddenly they're chatting a little bit more with you and you're communicating differently.
Yeah, the word for that in psychology is distantiating. And what it means is if you want to talk to somebody about something that you suspect is going to be difficult for them to talk about, you distance it. So in the case of a kid and you're wanting to communicate some information or understand them, you say, you know, can I ask your opinion about something? I was talking to my friend the other day who has a son who's about the same age as you, and he's doing X, Y, and Z at school. Do you have any advice for that parent? Then the
That's
kid will say, well, you need to get them off the screens and spend more time with them and try talking to them, that sort of thing.
that's brilliant. I like that workaround.
Thank you.
Well, let's get back to the kids who are a little trickier, who were struggling a little bit more, maybe as a parent or as a child, to just make our way through the world. There's a lot of entitlement that we're seeing in generations. Maybe every generation feels that the one underneath them is entitled, but maybe
Spirit.
it's part of what we're seeing so much defiance or different things about. Is there a way we can reverse that, or at least within the purview of what we can control?
Well, my way of looking at it is the current generation of kids, the Gen Alphas and the Gen Zs, you know, we've never lived at any other time in human history where people are as safe as they are now, who have their basic needs being met on a regular basis. You know, unless folks are struggling financially, and I know there are plenty of people out there like that. Most of the kids that I know, they've got a cell phone, they have a bedroom with all kinds of stuff in it, they've got gaming systems, parents drive them everywhere. They're pretty comfortable. And the current crop of parents, unlike previous generations, are, I think, more inclined to buy their kids stuff, right? It's sort of a belief that loving parents buy their kids an Xbox. Parents bought me stuff, but for Christmas, but it wasn't like they would spend on me year round. It was unthinkable for them to do that. So already you're over providing for them. And I think the antidote to that is to say no sometimes. If the kid says I want a $500 gaming system, it's like, no, we can't afford that. That's too much. Now, if you want to talk with me about how we can work together, maybe I contribute some and you contribute some. But you're going to have to figure out a way to come up with a couple of $100, which I completely support. Is, you know, and it's also okay to say to kids, we can't afford that and not be guilty about that. That's how they learn to understand that the resources are limited and that they have an obligation to participate in the generation of resources rather than just assuming their parents are going to buy them everything.
I think that's very important. And when you're in a place like Park City, which has a lot of very upscale folks, you can't keep up with the Joneses. The Joneses might be billionaires. So most of us are not going to be able to do that. So to help them learn little self-sufficiency early is
Oh,
great.
sure. And when people have everything, they value nothing, right? So kids who grow up in situations where there's just enormous wealth, it comes to them so easily. Everything they want, they have. And so they don't really value much of the stuff that they do have. If you want a kid to value a possession, ask them to earn it. right? Go out and do the hard work to generate the money. Then they'll treasure that thing. But if you just hand it to them, it's like, and then they toss it away and ask for the next thing.
I think we all probably know that, but it might be the most important thing that I've heard all day because you have to be reminded of these wisdoms.
They are.
So these are some of the things we've been talking about how to ki get kids to not behave in certain ways. What if we want them, in fact, to behave in a certain way? What if we're trying to get them to do something? What are some of the most effective strategies so we can have them do a chore or
Great
speak in a way
idea.
that's kind to their parents or siblings?
Great question. So let me give an example of, I think I'll pick disrespect if that's okay. We can do chores, we can do homework, but it
Oh,
all basically
disrespect
follows
is great.
the same principle, which is, first of all, adopting a culture within the family that disrespect is never okay, right? And there are many families that I've worked with who allow their kids to curse, or when their kids curse at them, they don't really do much in response to it. It's like, that's a hard no. We don't talk to each other that way. I am respectful to you. And of course, parents have to be respectful to their kids if they want their kids to be respectful to them. So this is what I want. And when you speak to me in a disrespectful way, I'm never going to be okay with that. So just to walk you through the steps. So if you're talking to a 15-year-old and you're asking them maybe to get started on their chore or to do their homework, and they raise their voice and say, "Get away from me. That's stupid. Leave me alone," which feels very disrespectful to me. The first prompt would be, "Hey, it's not okay to talk to me that way. So can you walk that back, please, and try to speak to me maybe at least in a neutral way, but friendly would be awesome if you could pull that
Would you
off."
like to rephrase
Exactly. And so if the kid can, "Look, I'm sorry. All right. I will do my homework, but I'm doing something else right now. Would it be okay if I got started an hour from now instead of immediately?" Absolutely. Totally. But what if you give that prompt, "Hey, not okay to talk to me that way," and the kid continues to be disrespectful, which is a very common thing, or the kid refuses to do their chore, refuses to do their homework, or whatever it is that you want them to do. Depending upon the age of the child, if you're talking a teenager, that's when you leverage their screens. And the easiest, simplest, most straightforward way to do that is, "Look, it's not okay to talk to me that way. Go ahead, please, and put your phone up on the kitchen counter. And I'd like it to stay there until you can be nice to me for a while, until you've been kind to me for a while." For a while is not defined. It's however long you feel the kid has now engaged in the positive behavior. The way you elicit a positive behavior is you give a kid a reason for doing that, a reason to not be disrespectful. So the phone up on the kitchen counter doesn't have to be there for very long. It could be an hour or two. If they are massively disrespectful, like they blow up and say super unkind things, probably it's going to be there for a day or two. But you never give a kid the timeline. It's when I think you've earned it. You can start earning it right now if that's what you want to do by accepting the consequence. Or you can be mad for a couple of days and then start earning it. That's completely up to you. Kids hate being without their screens. And it's a little harder if you have a kid who won't put their phone up on the kitchen counter, but there's so many workarounds to that. But basically, you now, the thing that you want is no longer available to you. And the only way to get it is if you do for me the thing that I've asked you to do. So no screens until your homework's done, no screens until the dishwasher is empty. It's the easiest thing to do is to leverage some sort of electronics. With a younger kid, a 5, 6, 7-year-old, who may not have access to many electronics, although a lot of kids that age still do, I would just use timeout. Timeout's pretty simple. "Look, it's not okay to tell me no. It's not okay to talk to me that way. Please go down to your bedroom and take a timeout, please." And in the book, I outline a version of timeout that I just think is exquisite. And it's one that most parents aren't familiar with. It works beautifully. Parents often give up on timeout because what if the kid doesn't go? Or what if they yell and scream in timeout? But this version of timeout that's in the book, I learned it many, many years ago from somebody else. It's awesome. So that's how you do it. Is you gotta behave. This is what I want. And in order for you to get the things that you want, you have to give me what I want.
Well, I don't want to dissuade anyone from getting this book because it's a fantastic book, but could you give us a hint on the timeout situation?
Sure. So I'll describe it to you as briefly and as simply as I can. You got to give kids a reason to go on their timeout. So think about this. If a kid is not following directions, not doing something you want them to do, and then the response to that is, "Please take a timeout for not listening to me," why in the world would they go? And I always give timeouts in their bedroom. But why would they go? They're already not listening to you, not following directions. And now you've given them a second directive to go to their bedroom. Who in their right mind would do that? So that's the problem with it. So the way it works is you actually have two kinds of timeouts. There's the short one and there's the long one. So the short timeout is, you know, please take a timeout for not listening to me. And the kid quietly walks down to their bedroom, goes inside and is quiet. That's the timeout that I want. It's peaceful. It's easy. They complied right away. And then they're in there for just a ridiculously short amount of time. And by ridiculously short, I mean about a minute, sometimes even less. Because all you want is them to listen to you at that point. If they go down to the room quietly, they're compliant again. So you go down to the room, you take them off their timeout, and then they go right away to the thing that they refuse to do, right? So if you ask them to get started on their chore and they tell you no, please take a timeout for not listening. They go down, they tell you what their timeout is for, and they go right to the chore, right? However, any kid that doesn't go right to their timeout, they argue, they complain, they refuse to go, they carry on, they hit the wall as they're going, they get in their bedrooms and they yell and scream about how unfair you are to them. That now is automatically a long timeout. And a long timeout is in the vicinity, depending upon how old the kid is, around 10 or 15 minutes, much, much longer than the short timeout. And that 10 or 15 minutes does not begin until the kid is in their room and completely quiet. And if they start to fuss and carry on, the clock stops, starts all over again, they have to give you 15 minutes of complete quiet. Right. So when you set it up like that, so you say, okay, please take a timeout for not listening. Most kids figure out it just makes a lot more sense to go to it and not fuss. And the ones who do fuss, it's like, all right, well, you're going to be down there longer. That's up to you. And it doesn't start till you're down there in quiet. They take their long timeout and they still go back to the thing that they refuse to do. So it works so well. There's more to it than what I've just said, but that's the idea.
Oh, that's brilliant. Thank you for giving us a hint. And please do check out the book. We've been talking with Dr. Paul Sanseri, who's written a new book called Gentle Parenting Reimagined, How to Make It Work with Oppositional and Defiant Kids. But I would suggest that any parent who's got young kids that they occasionally find challenging, and I'm really thinking that's everybody, should check out this book because it's got terrific strategies, no matter what kind of challenges or complex situations you may be dealing with.
For sure, for sure. And thank you, Mary Beth. It's been a pleasure to be here. It's been a really enjoyable chat. I appreciate that.
Oh, well, thank you for joining us in The Mountain Life, Dr. Paul Sanseri. We are so happy to have had the chance to talk with you. Thank you.
Thank you so much.
Welcome back to The Mountain Life. I'm Lynn Ware Peak.
And I'm Mary Beth Maziarz.
There are many things that we don't understand about trauma. We may not even realize that seemingly insignificant events in our own lives will surface as trauma. Well, our next conversation will be about trauma and something called dissociation that many use as a coping strategy. Our next guest, local resident, Dr. Pamela Fuller, is a licensed clinical psychologist and now a local author. She has written a new book called Disconnecting to Survive, Understanding and Recovering from Trauma-Based Dissociation. Pamela, welcome to The Mountain Life. It's great to have you.
Oh, thank you so much for having me. I'm excited to be here and talk about this important topic.
Trauma is an important topic. I think we throw around that word quite often, and there are so many different forms that trauma takes in our lives. And like I said in the intro, it can be small enough that we don't even realize it's trauma, or the very obvious traumas that many people have unfortunately experienced. So can you start off by just kind of describing what trauma is?
Sure. It's a great question. And it is used more and more, even just kind of loosely, I would say, for people at times. You know, we have our diagnostic definition of trauma for, especially like for post-traumatic stress disorder. And that is when there's a significant event that occurs. It could tend to be life-threatening or threat to body integrity. For children, it could be witnessing something. For adults, it can be as well. We've really struggled with a specific definition of trauma for people. But really, more importantly, isn't so much the traumatic event, but the person's response to it, as well as there's some mediating factors there, especially about social support or for children. It's the nature of attachment that the nature of the attachment for a child who goes through a traumatic event. If there's a secure and protective attachment there, then that can help to buffer them from some of the responses. But if they have an insecure attachment, like disorganized attachment, then they can actually much more likely to have traumatic effects, including dissociation, which we're going to talk about, I'm sure, a little bit more. So some things that might be really traumatic for one person is kind of part of everyday work experience or life for somebody else and doesn't have the same kind of impact on them. So what we really look for is, what have you been through and how does it affect you? And do they have some of those more significant or interfering stress responses, these trauma responses, that then interfere with their life afterwards?
Yes. So let's talk about this word dissociation. And you mentioned to me and corrected me in the beginning before we went on air that it's not disassociation. The word is dissociation. So what does dissociation mean and how does it surface?
So we all dissociate from time to time, the mild dissociative kinds of responses where, you know, you miss the exit while you're driving down the road, or you kind of go away while someone's talking to you. Those are not impairing for us. Those are just normal, brief kind of absorption. But trauma-based dissociation very often first occurs during a traumatic event as a protective response. It's automatic, it's involuntary, and it's a psychological and physical response to a danger. And what happens is the person ends up disconnecting either internally, like from their thoughts or their feelings or their body, or outside of themselves. They disconnect from the situation that they're in, from people, from their environment. So it's a disconnection for protection. I'm sure you know the fight or flight kind of biologically based fear responses that we often talk about. People are very familiar with those. And those are more sympathetic nervous system driven. Those are those and kind of get amped up and your heart rate's up, your breathing's up, but your muscles are tense, you're ready to fight or flight. Dissociation is also one of those automatic responses, but it's a freeze response. And the more dissociative the response, the more parasympathetically nervous system driven it is, which means there's more of a shutdown. So you have lowered breathing and a lower heart rate and a reduced response to pain, emotional numbing, just more and more of a shutting down. And so it's one of our evolutionarily adaptive defense strategies that can happen automatically during a traumatic event, especially when there's not a physical escape from it. It's really this brilliant thing that our brain and our body do. It's a mental escape when there's no physical escape.
Is it similar in a way to almost shock, the way the body physically creates a situation of kind of slowing everything down and helping?
Yeah, that's a great question. It does feel like that many times for people, but there's just so many variations in what the dissociative response can be. So for example, an adult or a child, if they're being harmed by a person, if they have a dissociative response, again, remember, it's not intentional. It's an automatic thing that the brain and body do. They may describe feeling like kind of hazy or foggy, that there's sort of this mental, you know, cognitive detachment. They may not feel things emotionally. They may not have as much of a response to pain. They may feel out of body. Or they may entirely go away and not remember the event at all.
Yeah. The first exposure I had to something like that was during natural childbirth.
Yes.
And I remember them in the books and in the midwife talking a little bit about how if you're able to move through it without certain medications, how there's a form of haziness that comes around the experience. And it's actually a helpful way that nature keeps you from despair, you know, during this really intense physical experience. Would that be some ways that dissociation works for you?
Well, it's a great view on that, because it's something that it overall is a positive experience that you're talking about. So then that would be something that we would do to help move us through that. The trauma-based dissociation is more when you have this generally an interpersonal threat, you know, that there's someone, something trying to harm you. So whether that's sexual abuse, physical abuse, domestic violence, war, there can be some medical traumas. I wouldn't include birth usually as a medical trauma. It can be, but, you know, usually, but that through medical traumas, or even for people who might be more at risk for discrimination or marginalized, that we actually have some emerging data about that higher rates of racial discrimination is associated with higher rates of trauma-based dissociation.
Yeah. So my son is 26 now. When he was 7, he was diagnosed with Hodgkin's lymphoma. And, you know, as a parent going through your child having a life-threatening disease, it can be, of course, very traumatic. During that time, I was calm and present and not emotional. And I was there. And I wonder if that's dissociation now, because following it, once he got over it and we're all on the other side, I couldn't even talk about it without bursting into tears for like 10 or 15 years.
Yes. And that putting some of those emotions at bay, you needed to do that in order to survive.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, you couldn't really deal with all of your feelings and thoughts about it at a time when you're trying to survive a very traumatic and stressful situation.
Yes, yes. And so, you know, when we come back into what dissociation is, it's something that helps us cope. It's something that helps us function. Are you trying to help your patients engage in dissociation or manage dissociation?
Yeah. So we're talking about it being protective and helpful in the situation, right? So like, you know, like when your son was going through that, or when someone's experiencing abuse or neglect or, you know, any kind of mistreatment interpersonally, in that time, it's protective. It becomes, when it becomes more of an automatic way of responding after that, that's when it becomes more of an impairing kind of dissociation that we want to address as a problem. We sort of appreciate it for what it did in that moment. It's just that we tend to respond to any kinds of trauma reminders the same way that we responded to the initial threat, the initial incident.
So would this be things like hypervigilance or like what kind of effects would you feel in your body or your mind that might indicate dissociation?
Yeah, and it's really important to discriminate between what you just said and what dissociation is. So when it starts to become an automatic kind of way of responding to perceived threats in the future, and that can get really generalized for people who've been through something traumatic. It can be, you know, maybe there was, you know, a certain situation or place, but then it gets generalized to going out at all, you know, or it may be a certain male or female person, but then it gets generalized to being afraid of all people. So that then there starts to be this distortion in like what I really need to be afraid of. And if they dissociate in that, then obviously there could be more adaptive ways of responding, more helpful ways that we want to help them with. So what it looks like, dissociation, the person may report that they feel like really disconnected from their emotions, like they're emotionally numb. They might feel like things around them just don't feel real. Like it's kind of hazy or distorted for them. They may not, they may have a higher or lower response to pain. They may feel like they're not real. They may have things that they don't remember either in daily life because they're kind of foggy all the time. So they're not really taking in things and remembering it, but also disconnected from painful memories. They don't have access to those. So there's a lot of disconnection to different things. You know, body doesn't feel like their own body. So of course it can be along a continuum. It can be mild dissociative symptoms all the way over to people who have separate personalities or subselves, what we have with dissociative identity disorder. You know, so you can think along the range, or it can be a little bit someone's experience in it, or it can feel like they're just really not there all the time.
So I understand how someone listening to this might be able to recognize some of those things in themselves if they've had some trauma. Mm-hmm. How might you recognize this if someone in your life might have some of this going on, and how might we support that person?
Mm-hmm. Well, interestingly, with that, there's sometimes a person doesn't even know they dissociate. Often they don't, you know, and so that's hard for them to report to somebody else. That's why it's really important if somebody's wondering about that, that they learn more about it, they see a professional who can assess with them about it. Because I've had many people say, no, I don't do that. Or they've never, you know, more and more people are they've heard of it now. You know, it's out there in social media, but they don't really know what it is. Or it's been something they've done so much, they don't realize it's a problem. So they may not recognize it, which also means that people who care about them may not either. They might see it. What they might see is it may feel like the person just seems sort of distant from them. Like they're just not really there with you. And sometimes that's just a physical sense of that. Other times it's like, it just seemed like you're kind of somewhere else. You know, where are you? Can you come back to me in this way? They may not remember things. You say they did something or you talked about something, they don't remember it because mentally they weren't there in the moment, even though they may seem like they were.
Yeah. Wow. So, if you're just joining us on The Mountain Life, we're having a conversation with local resident and clinical psychologist, Dr. Pamela Fuller. She has joined us to talk about her new book called Disconnecting to Survive, Understanding and Recovering from Trauma-Based Dissociation. And Pamela, I'm wondering if you could go into it a little further. If we have loved ones, people that we live with or are surrounded by, that, you know, we see doing this dissociative behavior, how can we further support them?
Well, part of that is helping them in a supportive way to recognize that you're noticing something's going on for them, you know, because the first and foremost is people being aware of when they're dissociating and that they can then be starting to figure out other ways that they may find to deal with the situation and, you know, to effectively deal with things, because know that the cue that triggers someone to dissociate is they don't feel safe. Something feels threatening. Something doesn't feel safe. So for example, if I see in therapy, it looks like somebody kind of goes away, that I just might say, oh, you know, I just noticed you. It doesn't seem like you're, something just happened here. I'm not sure what, but I'm not sure, you know, how present you are with me right now. And depending on the person, I work with them on what to do in that moment, because sometimes they're going to feel better if you just give them a moment. It might be that you just say, you know, I'm just right here. If you're, you know, feel like talking, or if there's anything that help you feel safer in this moment, I just want to support you in that. You can help to orient them, like to look around the room if they want to, so that they know that they're just there with you right now. So you think about, the brain and body needs to know this is okay right now. So we're helping them assess, like, how safe is this situation?
We know that going through, especially being a teenager, is a difficult time of life for anyone, even if it goes well. And so I'm wondering, you know, going back to trauma, what are those instances in which we experience maybe, and I don't want to call it, you know, low level or high level trauma. I don't know how you distinguish it, but those kinds of traumas that we don't realize are happening to us as we go through, you know, being a teenager. What are some of those traumas?
Well, I'm thinking about teenagers, and many people, they may say something's traumatic and that may not seem like it's traumatic to you, right? What we really want to look at again is, I mean, you know, there are the significant traumas, and again, interpersonal traumas like sexual assault, physical assault, emotional abuse. So, you know, in a teenager, a lot of times with relationships, to be looking at, are those safe relationships? Are they being harmed in any way from those?
I mean, those are the ones that seem obvious to us on the exterior, right?
Yes.
But I guess I'm talking about, we know that bullying can create trauma.
Yes.
But
yes.
Are there things that we as parents may not identify that are happening in their lives that end up being trauma? And many times we may just disregard them. And that's what, I guess, what I'm trying to get at. And maybe it's not just for teenagers, it's for anyone in our lives, any of our loved ones. I'm just trying to get at, you know, recognizing when there's a trauma, when we may not be able to identify it as such.
Well, I think that would always start with, if you're noticing a change in your child's behavior or mood. And that's really hard with teenagers. Because there's what's up, what's concerning and what's normal, right? So you start to look at what's the level of distress for the child or a teenager, as well as like, is it interfering with what they normally do? Are they doing what they're capable of? Or are they shutting down in some ways or not performing at school or in sports or in their life in the way they normally do? So if you see a significant change, that's always going to be a cue for a parent or a someone who cares of like, what's going on for you, that you can then start to look into, is there something that's been happening to you, some way that you're being treated or that you're feeling, that you're seeing yourself or others are seeing you, that's affecting you. You know, for example, teenagers figuring out so much about their identity, and that can involve also sexual orientation, gender identity, and just more generally about who am I? And so during that time, they can also be mistreated for how they're identifying, how they're seeing themselves. And if you're seeing a change in the child in ways that are concerning for you, so it's impairing, distressing, interfering for them, then I would say, oh, is something, you know, potentially going on for them that might be traumatic. So again, we don't define for people outside of, you know, our diagnoses what a traumatic event is. We're looking at how is it affecting them.
So what's the first approach to helping someone heal from a dissociative situation that is not effective for them anymore?
Well, interestingly, a lot of our trauma treatment models, they haven't systematically included assessing for dissociation yet. And we know from some of the research that if you're in a trauma treatment intervention and you're not, and you're dissociating, it actually runs counter to what you're trying to do in trauma treatment. A lot of times, eventually, you're trying to help the person be exposed to the things they went through to process through them. But if they dissociate during that, then you're just reinforcing that as a way of dealing with being exposed to traumatic reminders. And so first and foremost, it is making sure that across the different trauma treatment models, you're with a therapist who is assessing and just seeing if dissociation is going on for you, and start to address that. We don't have one way that all the research says this is the way to treat dissociation, but we do have some general guidelines and main things that we do. And I talk about that in the second part of my book. The first part's about what is dissociation and the neurobiology of it and different types of dissociation. So people can get a sense of like, oh, is this fit for me or not? And to what extent? And then the second half is about what do you do about it? And some of the fundamentals are helping a person to feel safe in the present moment, that you start right there of being able to do that and recognize what are your kind of your warning signs that you're starting to dissociate? What does it look like for you? Are there certain situations in which that comes up for you or certain things that activate that for you, so that we can start to be aware of it and more self-attuned, I would say, that we want to be more attuned to our body and our thoughts and our feelings, our awareness of that. Then you can start to do some things differently in that moment rather than just automatically dissociating. But it takes time and effort and awareness to do that.
It does. Who is your ideal reader? Is it a person who feels they might be suffering from dissociation, or what kind of person do you hope to benefit most?
So it's for people who know they dissociate or wonder if they do, for the people who care about them and want to support them, family members and friends. And it's also for mental health professionals. My first and foremost reader is the person who's experiencing this or wonders if they do, but it's also beneficial to mental health professionals. It's still something we're building more awareness in the medical and mental health community about what dissociation is and what to do about it. And so it's for them as well.
I remember a few years ago when that The Body Keeps the Score book came out.
Yes,
and
yes.
It was such an interesting book because I think originally it was a lot of therapists and people like that reading it. And then it became just a general interest, wonderful resource for all kinds of people. So I hope that the same could happen for your book.
Oh, thank you. Yes, thanks.
Our guest is Dr. Pamela Fuller. She's a licensed clinical psychologist, and her book is called Disconnecting to Survive, Understanding and Recovering from Trauma-Based Dissociation. Pamela, where can we find your book?
Well, it's through Springer Publishing. So on springer.com, amazon.com, Barnes & Noble. I'm hoping to do a book signing there soon at our local Barnes and Noble, getting that put together. Many places online.
And if people would like to get in touch with you, maybe to see you professionally, I know you're a local resident, but your practice is in Salt Lake, but you also do a lot of telehealth, I guess would call it, which is a great way for more people to access help. So tell us how to find you.
Well, they could find me on Psychology Today if they just want to read more about my background and my training and that sort of thing. Or they could email me at Pamela Fuller, PhD. @gmail.com.
Okay. Pamela, thank you so much. This is really informative. And it feels so educational about a topic that we ought to know about, but it seems as though we just don't. Is that what you find?
Yes. Yes. I think that we're starting to have more attention to it, growing attention to it, but also a lot of confusion about what it is and what it isn't. You know, we're in a good place to just keep raising awareness for it.
I just had one question. Is there anything that you might want to add about the new year coming up that we could take into account for our mental health?
Oh, yeah. Well, you know, of course, this is the time where people start thinking about making their resolutions, right, for New Year's. And I need to do more of this or less of that. And those tends to get, aren't sustained when we make changes really abruptly like that. And then people get upset with themselves. And so I really encourage for New Year's to think about discovering something about yourself that is already a part of who you are that you're not aware of yet. So maybe that's a talent or a quality characteristic of yours. It's like finding this ember within you and putting the bellows on it and saying, oh, this is something about me that focuses instead of on change, but more about who you already are and what you're capable of being. So that's
I love that ember. That's beautiful.
It really is. Dr. Pamela Fuller, thank you so much.
Oh, thank you for having me. It was wonderful to be here.